citing its humanitarian impact and the dire consequences for the peace process in Yemen. UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock has said the designation could cause a famine not seen in the past four decades. Yemen has been devastated by the Saudi-led war that started back in 2015. The UN has described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Ansarallah and its allied army units are fighting Riyadh and its regional allies, which are backed by Washington. The designation will come into effect on January the 19th, the last full day in office of President Donald Trump's administration.
In March 2015, Saudi Arabia and some of its allies launched a war on Yemen. Their main aim was to throw out the Ansarullah movement and reinstate former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi, who had fled to Saudi Arabia after resigning. The war, that so far had killed tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians, has been described by the UN as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. But right from the beginning, it was the United States and its Western allies that supported the war in different forms, either by supplying weapons to Riyadh or undermining the situation in Yemen. With only a few days left for US President Donald Trump in office, he is still trying to do the most harm to the Yemeni people and offer political assistance to his Arab ally, Saudi Arabia. On Monday, the US designated Yemen's Ansarullah as a terrorist group. Washington said the decision will take effect on January 19th, a day before Trump hands over power to his successor, Joe Biden. The move has drawn criticism from the international community and rights groups. UN officials have also opposed the designation, citing humanitarian impact and dire consequences for the peace process in Yemen.
I am extremely concerned about the impact of the decision from the United States to designate Ansarullah as a foreign terrorist organization. We fear, in my mission, that there will be inevitably a chilling effect on my efforts to bring the parties together.
During a UN Security Council briefing, World Food Programme Chief David Beasley also slammed the decision and called on the US to reverse it.
We are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions.
The US and some other Western countries are major suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia and have been supporting the war on Yemen since day one. Saudi bombardments have already devastated Yemen's infrastructure, turning many schools, hospitals, religious sites into rubble. But the Trump administration never heeded calls by rights groups and politicians inside the US to stop supplying arms to the kingdom. The United States has a history of military adventurism in West Asia. The Saudi-led war is part of a wider American plot to destabilize the region. Will Biden do something to stop the Saudi mayhem or follow the footsteps of his predecessor? That's what the world will be watching in the coming weeks.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have Mr. Mike Wallace, who is a member of European Parliament from Ireland South, joining us from Brussels. Also, we have Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Kim Sharif, joining us from London. Ms. Sharif, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mike Wallace in Brussels. Mr. Wallace, the U.S. has rejected pleas by numerous U.N. officials to reverse its decision, declaring the Ansarullah movement a terrorist group. The U.N. Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Mark Lowcock, has insisted that the U.S. must reverse its decision to avoid the risk of a famine not seen for decades. Why is the U.S. not considering these calls when the scope of death and devastation is clearly being pointed out?
Well, I don't understand why you'd be surprised at that. There's been a famine, and there's been huge problems in Yemen for a long time now, caused by the Saudi-UAE bombing campaign, supported by the US and sadly some of the European countries. And they haven't cared about the lives of the people of Yemen up to now. I don't know why you start thinking that they start caring about them in the last week of the presidency. And listen, don't forget as well, this started in 2015. And in March 2015, Obama was involved, and sadly the UN were involved, in allowing the Saudis and the UAE to start their bombing campaign. So the attitude of the US, whether they're Republican or Democrat, it hasn't been good in this situation. There is no rationale to the support to what the Saudis are doing. The truth be told, without mincing the words, what the Saudis in the UAE have engaged in Yemen is a form of genocide. They have literally been looking to starve the people into submission. They have targeted food production, they have targeted food warehouses, they have targeted water supply, they have targeted sanitary facilities, they have targeted medical facilities. This has been an attempt to beat the people of Yemen into submission. And it is very striking that there is so little coverage of the war in world media. There's been so little coverage at European Union level. I can tell you, I became a member of the European Parliament in July 2019. Now, there's hardly been a month since where I haven't tried to get Yemen raised as a topic of debate at the plenary, and I still haven't managed to do so. Next week, we will discuss Hong Kong for the fifth time. There's not one protester has been killed by Chinese police authorities in Hong Kong yet. And yet, we're talking for the fifth time in the European Parliament about the suppression of democracy in Hong Kong. And listen, I'm not saying there isn't problems there. There's problems everywhere. But yet, we cannot talk about Yemen in the European Parliament, despite the fact that it does represent probably the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet at the moment.
All right, let's turn over to Ms. Shadif in London. The executive director of the UN World Food Programme, David Beasley, has called on the U.S. to reverse its controversial decision. He warned quote, "We are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people in Yemen." Why is the U.S. ignoring these warnings?
That's because U.S. Itself has a history of committing genocide on the natives of America. That's how the U.S. came into existence. The U.S. history is thoroughly tainted with bloodshed and extermination of people systematically. And U.S. cannot handle the fact that Yemen is another country that has come out of U.S. hegemony. And that's what is worrying the U.S. And it doesn't care how many millions of people die. Because if you think of the figures that of children, for example, there are 50,000 children under the age of 50 dying per annum due entirely to an illegal blockade, arbitrarily enforced, strictly enforced, complete disregard to UN search mechanisms, etc. So 50,000 children under the age of 5 alone per annum, that is horrifying. That's clearly genocide. That is terrorism, my friend. That is exactly what terrorism is about. It's terrorizing the people of Yemen into submission. And that's what this decision, which is irrational and illegal, is about. If we want to go and talk about who are the terrorists, real terrorists are really basically Saudi coalition, who are friends of the U.S. Let's go back and look at the time, how this business of terrorism started. In the 80s, the U.S. regime itself used the Saudi regime to recruit terrorists for the Afghan Mujahideen war to face the Soviets. Hillary Clinton admitted on TV that they created these terrorist outfits in order to confront the Soviets. Mohammed bin Salman also admitted that he created these Takfiri Wahhabi extremist terrorists in order to assist their friends, U.S., etc. So for them now to turn around and call Ansarullah, who are the only party in Yemen who have been very successful at fighting terrorism to the extent that they have eliminated all forms of terrorism from the areas under their control, to call these people terrorism is itself terrorism in my view, because it seems to me that U.S. regime is using political terrorism now as a last resort to try and force the Yemeni people to submit to its will. And that's just not going to happen. The difficulty with the U.S. is that it cannot face losing another war to another small country, defenseless, weak, small country like it happened in Vietnam. And on this occasion, in relation to Yemen, it had used its puppet regimes, its proxies, Saudi coalition, to do its dirty work in return for selling them unlimited amounts of weapons of mass destruction and making them believe that they're going to be dominant empires in the region, which is a false promise that is never going to happen. And in addition, they are using terrorist proxies as ground forces. This has been reported widely by many, many highly respected outlets like CNN. Al-Qaeda and Daesh are receiving weapons from Saudi coalition. Safar Ahmed of the BBC reports that ground forces working alongside the Emiratis are Al-Qaeda and Daesh. The southern parts that are occupied by Saudi coalition are facing daily attacks of terrorism, assassinations, and you know the recent attack of Aden Airport and so on. All of these activities of terrorism actually belong to the US regime and its proxies, Saudi coalition. And the terrorist outfits such as Al-Qaeda and Daesh are nothing more than third grade, if you like, third grade proxies to carry out their dirty work for them. We've seen evidence of that in Syria, we've seen evidence of that in Iraq, and we see it in Yemen almost every day happening. You know, when we have regained control of Al-Baida province, there were so many nationalities from Chechnya, from Pakistan, from Bangladesh, from everywhere, Senegalese. These are terrorist mercenaries purchased by Saudi coalition on behalf of their US masters to come and kill Yemenis in their own country. And so to designate Ansarullah terrorists as terrorists is actually itself is terrorist. And in any event, we don't believe the US regime anymore about this business because
indeed,
having passed the JASTA law, to date, we haven't seen them indict or try any member of the Saudi royal family who are implicated in the 9/11 worst terrorist attack in recent history.
Okay,
so why haven't they tried any one of them?
I'll get back
we don't
to you
believe
in a minute,
their intelligence
Shadi.
At all.
I'm sorry,
Iraq
I'm going to interrupt you there. We're going to go back to our guest in Brussels, Mick Wallace. Mike Pompeo insisted that the State Department was aware of the concerns and would work with non-governmental groups and the United Nations to ensure that aid goes through. In that regard, Mark Locock has stated the following, that would licenses and exemptions for aid agencies prevent a catastrophe? The answer is no. What would prevent it? A reversal of the decision. Well, aid agencies cannot, they simply cannot replace the commercial import system. So here we have the same song and dance again. It's U.S. sanctions targeting innocent civilians.
Yeah, look, I don't think anyone really cares about what Mike Pompeo thinks or says anymore. He's on the way out, and he's been a loose cannon for a long time and never made an awful lot of sense when he spoke anyway. And it was a poor reflection on America that they allowed someone like Pompeo to behave in that position in such a reckless fashion for a long period. So, I mean, I don't think anyone should be surprised with anything that what Pompeo would say or do. Whether the people replacing him would be much different remains to be seen. But the truth is that what the Saudis have been doing since 2015 and the UAE would not have been possible without Western support. The Saudis, they don't have their own soldiers in there. They can't train their own soldiers. They can't repair their own vehicles and aircrafts. They can't fuel their own aircrafts in the air without US or French or UK support. This war could not take place without Western support. And yet, the Western countries themselves have so little to say about it, but they have been happy to make money from it. They have been happy to sell arms to the Saudis and to the UAE, irrespective of what they do with them. It just goes to show, I mean, we hear the likes of the French and the British and the Americans pontificating about human rights, and yet they would sell arms to anybody to do anything because it's just about the money. And they make money from arms. I mean, Trump, in his honesty, once said, when it was put to him by a journalist in Washington, and the journalist said to him, "Do you not think, Mr. President, that maybe it's time that we stop selling arms to the Saudis because they're doing terrible things in Yemen with the arms that we're selling them?" And Trump says, "Oh, I'm not so sure about that. I'm not so sure that'd be a good idea. Supposing we didn't sell arms to them. Supposing it meant that we lost 20,000 jobs because the Saudis and UAE didn't buy any arms from us. First of all, we'd lose money, we'd lose jobs, American jobs, and where would the Saudis buy the stuff then? The Russians? Chinese? Don't think this is a good idea," he says. I mean, look at it. There's no morals involved. There's no principles involved.
Right.
The large powers of the world, like the US, sadly, no longer have any respect for international law. And that's a big problem.
Kim Sharif in London, a spokesman for Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement, said the regime's waging war under the protection of U.S. President Donald Trump, who's leaving office in just a matter of days, must now stop their bloody aggression. Do you think a Biden administration's policy will be any different from the Trump White House?
We hope that that's going to be the case, and we're going to hold to Mr. Biden to what he had promised before he got elected. That's one thing. I mean, we do know that this war, this illegal war on Yemen, was started while Obama was in power. But then so much has happened since. And Biden was part of the people who have been a witness to the horrors that have been committed in Yemen in their names. And there's also potential legal liability, because sooner or later there's going to be international tribunal to investigate what has happened in Yemen. And there is a campaign ongoing at the moment in the US as well as in the UK, and an international day of action planned on 25th of January, with a view to reminding Mr. Biden about his promise before his election. So we do hope that the new US system administration will see common sense and stop this horror, because it's genocide, it's illegality, it's everything disgusting. It's not just illegal, it's disgusting, because it's just the Yemeni blood being spilled every day. Young children, people are just dying hungry. This can't be right. And we're calling upon the international community, the rest of the Western world, who have a voice at the UN level, to advance a resolution to demand cessation of military campaign against Yemen, and to demand the lifting of this illegal blockade to save millions of lives. And of course, ignore this call for branding otherwise innocent and very good people at fighting terrorism, in fact, like Ansarullah, branding them terrorists when they are completely far from it, ideologically, politically, on every level. And what they're calling Ansarullah is not the government of Sana'a. The government of Sana'a does contain communists. It contains the Congress Party. It contains variety, many other political parties of the Yemen. So it is wrong to try and mislabel them deliberately by the U.S. and to follow in that footstep and regard this government as a bare militia when they are not. Otherwise, they wouldn't have such advanced military capabilities. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to contain the country's institutions and preserve the national constitution. And majority of the people are actually internally displaced in their regions, the regions under their control, contrary to what's happening in the parts that are illegally occupied by Saudi coalition.
Right. Let's go back to Mr. McWallace in Brussels. Joe Biden takes office on January the 20th. Can and will the designation be revoked by Biden's Secretary of State? And if so, do you think the next administration will bring more of the same to the table? And if he does reverse it in time, will the damage be done by then?
Well, first of all, I don't expect the Democratic administration to be much different from the Republican administration going out. But secondly, what I would say is that the support for the Saudi-UAE bombing campaign in Yemen has been apart from the fact that they've been able to sell all these arms to these two entities, apart from that, there hasn't been much positive in it for the Western countries involved, namely the US, France, and the UK, and unfortunately other European countries as well have armed UAE and Saudis over the last couple of years. But I actually do think that it will be difficult, not that Biden thinks much different from Trump, because US imperialism will most likely continue on its merry way. Biden is happy for the US to spend $740 billion on military in 2021. The Democrats voted for it. They do not want universal health care for their own citizens. So, the madness of this, a country that has huge problems at home, they have huge demands on millions and millions of their own people needing a better life, needing better health care, better education, better social facilities. There's huge levels
Very
of
well.
In America today. But yet, the U.S. is still most likely to continue on its path of imperialism.
Okay, I'm going to have to jump in there. I'm sorry, Mr. Wallace, we're short of time. Allow me to thank my guest, member of European Parliament of Ireland South, Mr. Mick Wallace, joining us from Brussels. Also, thanks to Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Kim Sharif, joining us from the British capital, London. Also, thanks for staying with us on this debate. Goodbye for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
والذين هاجروا في سبيل الله ثم قتلوا أو ماتوا ليرزقنهم الله حسنا وإن الله لهو خير الرازقين.
And those who emigrated for the cause of Allah and then were killed or died, Allah will surely provide for them a good provision. And indeed, it is Allah who is the best of providers.
والذين هاجروا في سبيل الله ثم قتلوا أو ماتوا ليرزقنهم الله رزقا حسنا وإن الله لهو خير الرازقين.
And those who migrate in the cause of Allah and are then slain or die, certainly will Allah provide them with a goodly sustenance, and verily Allah is the best of providers. So after talking about disbelief and the retribution of the disbelievers in the previous verses, in this section of the chapter, the verses start talking about the reward for those who migrate in the Almighty Allah's cause. You may remember that in the former holy verses, the Holy Quran spoke about some emigrants whom were sent out from their houses because of the name of the Almighty Allah, and that they supported the divine religion, and this was the cause of them being sent out from their houses. And in this verse, they are considered as an excellent group. The verse says, وَالَّذِينَ هَاجَرُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ ثُمَّ مَاتُوا أَوْ قُتِلُوا. And those who migrate in the cause of Allah and are then slain or die, لَيَرْزُقَنَّهُمُ اللَّهُ رِزْقًا حَسَنًا. Certainly will Allah provide them with a goodly sustenance. So at first, we have to consider this fact that any action which is done for a certain goal and a good purpose is a value, and in this case, an emigration which is done for the certain goal, which is Almighty Allah's cause and purpose, is of course considered as a great value. And in this verse, it is told that the death of the emigrant people is a kind of martyrdom. And in this regard, we have to consider the fact that death or martyrdom is not considered a value, and it's not the matter of significance. But what is important here is that the person is on the path of Allah. That is the reason why he is considered as a martyr. Anyway, when the Almighty Allah says that those who migrate in the cause of Allah and are then slain or die, certainly will Allah provide them with a goodly sustenance, لَيَرْزُقَنَّهُمُ اللَّهُ رِزْقًا حَسَنًا. Some commentators have said that this Quranic phrase, رِزْقًا حَسَنًا, refers to some blessings that actually attract the person when he sees them, so that he cannot look at anything other than them. And it is only Allah that who can give a man such a sustenance.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jews.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
كيف رفعت
Insights into the Holy Quran
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Of course, in this regard, some of the Islamic scholars have mentioned an occasion of revelation for this verse. The shortened version of it is that at the advent of Islam, when the Muslim immigrants came into Medina, some of them died with a natural death, while some others suffered martyrdom. At this time, a group of the Muslim believers considered the virtue of martyrdom utterly for the martyrs. This holy verse was sent down, and it introduced both of those groups as the bearers of the best blessings of the Almighty Allah. That is why some of the commentators of the Holy Quran, taking this meaning, have concluded that giving the life in the path of Allah is important, whether it is by the way of martyrdom or it is by the way of natural death. Then whoever passes away for the cause of Allah and in the way of Allah will receive the reward appropriate for martyrs. It has been said, verily, those who are slain in the way of Allah and those who die in the way of Allah, both are martyrs. Dear listeners, we will continue talking about this verse and of course the next one, which is an example of this divine goodly sustenance which is mentioned in this verse in the later program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
The port of Hodeidah, which is the only outlet to the outside world for millions of Yemenis, is still suffering from a forced closure imposed by the Saudi-led coalition. This has caused thousands of workers to lose their jobs, increasing the rate of poverty and unemployment in the coastal governorate.
The workers at the port of Hodeidah include 3,500 workers in the port and 500 others in other fields of the port. The support of family and the closure of the port has eliminated the source of income of these people. The suspension of operations of the port has affected the lives of all Yemenis who depend on the port for the arrival of food and medicine.
This port is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis to receive essential supplies, and its continued closure means they can't easily have access to adequate food and medicine, not to mention the large economic losses for the Yemeni economy, estimated at over $1 billion.
The port of Hodeidah is one of the important ports in the Red Sea, and direct and indirect corporate losses are estimated at $1.24 billion in total. This is a large sum, since the Red Sea Ports Corporation is responsible for 70% of the imports sent to the 20 governorates for more than 20 million Yemenis.
Yemen has been suffering from a sea and air blockade since the Saudi-led coalition launched its war in March 2015, which has destroyed the country's infrastructure, killed tens of thousands of civilians, and starved millions of women and their children. As the Saudi war on Yemen approaches its seventh year, Yemeni's calls for the demilitarization of Port of Hodeidah continue to be ignored by the United Nations and other relevant international organizations. From Port of Hodeidah, Abdul Latif Al-Washali.
Turkey has the longest continental coastline in the eastern Mediterranean and rejects the maritime boundary claims of Greece and the Greek Cypriot administration in the region. Ankara says these claims are excessive and violate the sovereign rights of both Turkey and Turkish Cypriots. The EU decided on punitive measures against Turkey last year after Ankara asserted its rights in the region by sending several drill ships to explore for energy on its continental shelf. However, the implementation of sanctions has been postponed until March, and Turkey says it is ready to get its relationship with the EU back on track in 2021.
We are inviting Greece, which has been increasing its airspace violations and unlawful activities in islands that are demilitarized, to give up their actions that are raising tensions. I believe that the exploratory talks with our neighbor Greece, which will start on the 25th of January, will, God willing, herald a new period.
European diplomats have signaled the dispute between Turkey and Greece is of paramount importance and also that progress has already been made.
What I have felt from my discussion with the minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu is progress has been made too, both in the way of relations between Turkey and Greece and in relations between Turkey and Cyprus and in relations between Turkey and France, to give you some examples.
Another issue high on the agenda for talks is Turkey's EU membership bid. Negotiations began in 2005, but have since come to a standstill. Erdogan says Turkey's membership will be a good thing for the EU, now Britain has left the bloc.
Uncertainties that are increasing with Brexit can only be dissipated with Turkey receiving its rightful place in the European family. We, as a country, are ready to put our relations back on track and create positive agendas with a long-term perspective.
In recent talks, Turkey has been quick to remind the EU of its dependence on Ankara when it comes to preventing hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants from trying to cross into European nations. Turkey says by taking initiatives in places like Syria and Libya, it is contributing to the EU's security considerably and is calling on the bloc not to allow disputes with individual members like Greece and France to jeopardize that. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In a vote which fell almost totally along party lines, Donald Trump has become the first United States president to be impeached twice. Before Bill Clinton in 1998, there was only one other impeachment ever, reflecting how highly polarized the nation has become. The impeachment appears totally symbolic. A trial in the Senate and a two-thirds vote in favor is needed to actually convict and expel Trump. The Senate will not meet until January 19th, and Joe Biden will be inaugurated as president on January 20th.
Trump will be out of the office in 7 days. I mean, you know, like, I think that I understand and I'm sympathetic to people who want him out earlier, but I just don't think that it's the a priority of anybody who wants to make sure that this doesn't continue. And the goal should be to cut across the sympathies for these right-wing actions.
Just 1 week earlier, the entire world was shocked after a protest burst into the Capitol building, the home of America's parliament, stopping the counting of the Electoral College's disputed presidential votes. Anger, accusations, despair, and emotional outbursts immediately swept the nation and may not lessen even after impeachment. Some top media have compared the events, which occurred on the date 1-6, to 9-11. The Democrat-dominated House of Representatives successfully charged Trump with incitement to insurrection so quickly that many wonder if they have set a dangerous precedent of a so-called snap impeachment. Worries are widespread that the only practical result of the historic impeachment is even more division in a nation already racked by the coronavirus, racial strife, police brutality, years of tremendous cultural disunity, and economic catastrophe.
I think that impeachment is a good side dish, but it should not be the focus of anybody who considers themselves to be on the left. I understand why the center might do that, why neoliberals might do it, but Keynesian, you know, if you will, actions such as the $2,000, universal health care, that these things need to be put forth to undermine the growth of the right, the growing right, which I don't think impeachment is going to address.
The controversial decision of the House of Representatives came after the FBI warned that armed anti-inauguration protests are expected across all 50 state capitals starting on January 16th and ending on Inauguration Day at the earliest. The United States will remain in a historic state of tension and animosity until then, and maybe even long after. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Saudi atrocities against Yemeni children are endless. Hodeidah is one of the worst affected areas in Yemen. The children there suffer from life-threatening malnutrition. They are in dire need of assistance and medical treatment.
Hodeidah has a very high malnutrition burden for several reasons. The main reason is the aggression that has besieged the governorate and its coast, preventing fishermen from going to the sea and obtaining adequate food. Another reason is the rising unemployment. Here is the 3-year-old Saba struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit.
The 3-year-old Saba is struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit. The United Nations warned weeks ago that at least 98,000 Yemeni children were suffering from malnutrition at record high rates. However, despite the ongoing collapse of the health system in Yemen, there has yet been no international response.
There has been a noticeable increase in the number of malnutrition cases in the past 2 months. They exceed the hospital's capacity, where we only have 12 beds. We had to receive patients in other departments, such as the emergency department, and this affects the health of children and increases the number of deaths.
The health sector in Yemen has suffered a continuous deterioration amid the Saudi-led war in the country. Saudi-led coalitions of blockade has prevented the arrival of food and medicine to millions of Yemeni children and women. The Saudi-led coalition is not only targeting the Yemeni children with airstrikes, but also violates their most basic rights, such as access to food and medicine, in a clear breach of the international humanitarian law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Al-Hudaydah.
Iran's navy has unveiled the country's largest military vessel called Makran. It is a mobile base that can carry choppers and support the military frigates of the Iranian Army's navy. This 228-meter auxiliary ship was in fact a trade ship, but the army changed it basically to turn into a floating port capable of carrying up to 82,000 tons of warships' needs. The support ship can also carry 5 helicopters and a battalion. It can travel for 1,000 days without having access to ports. Zereh was the other vessel unveiled by the Navy in the presence of top commanders.
The Iranian frigate called Zereh, or Armor, is an extremely useful vessel. It is very fast and powerful and can carry out its missions very well. It is equipped with advanced radars and electronic warfare facilities. Zereh can play a great role in safeguarding Iran's national interests. As the frigate is a totally indigenous one, it shows that our experts have successfully bypassed the sanctions.
Zereh is a missile-launching frigate of 47 meters length that can move at a speed of 35 nautical miles. It can launch cruise missiles up to 300 kilometers. After joining these two vessels, some southern drills called Marine Power 99 were staged to check the readiness of the forces.
These drills were not on our agenda,
The goal was to check the preparedness and quick reaction of our facilities and forces. Vessels, submarines, drones, coast-to-sea missiles were tested during this exercise, and they entered the mock danger zone extending over 600,000 kilometers.
The surface-to-surface cruise missiles, submarine, and flight units of the Iranian Navy took part in the drills.
With these two vessels joining the Iranian Navy, the country's waters are safer than before, and a clear message is sent to Iran's enemies that they should never think of waging a war against the country. Human Abedi, Konarak.
As things stand, it is very unclear how many people in the EU have so far actually received a COVID-19 vaccine, how many doses are currently being sent to each of the 27 member states, and when various groups can expect to get the jab. EU lawmakers have been discussing the issue in the European Parliament.
European Union citizens have a lot less vaccines available to them than they should have. The European Commission has planned this badly. Perhaps they were too bureaucratic.
On the 15th of October last, the European Commission set out clear guidelines to encourage each government in the EU to prepare for vaccination rollout, including the need to have sufficient numbers of trained personnel.
We invite the members to reflect on making sure that the necessary infrastructure is in place, that the necessary equipment is in place, taking into account the technical specificities of the vaccines.
Despite being given 2.5 months' notice, many EU countries did not prepare. Vaccines were left in boxes instead of being put into people's arms. We have been speaking to citizens about the vaccine rollout.
Things are not that well done at the moment. I think that we lack some information about everything. People need to know.
It was too slow, but now we have vaccines, then we must quickly act.
Yeah, I think it's better to have done it safely, but I mean the price to pay is that it may take a bit longer.
More people have now been vaccinated in the UK than in all of the 27 EU member states combined.
Could we have been doing more about creating better capacity building for the manufacturing of the vaccines? And could we have done more in order to adjust the expectations from the citizens about the speediness of how we roll out these vaccines?
Some lawmakers say the credibility of the EU is being undermined by the fact that some member states, such as Germany, Denmark and Cyprus, are seeking extra vaccines outside of the European Commission's vaccine strategy. With the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna vaccines having already been approved for use in the EU, the European Medicines Agency is due to give the green light to a third, the AstraZeneca vaccine, on the 29th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's oil ministry has signed major investment agreements with domestic contractors in a bid to boost crude oil production. As part of the deals, the National Iranian South Oil Company and the Iranian Offshore Oil Company agreed to contract out major onshore projects in four oil-rich provinces, as well as offshore projects in the Persian Gulf, to domestic companies. The projects are worth $1.2 billion. Oil Minister Bijan Namdar Zangane says this is the last stage of a plan that aims to boost Iran's crude output by some 300,000 barrels a day.
We have pursued this plan since a few years ago, and today the 31st contract was signed. The agreements will ramp up the output by increasing the recovery factor of our oil fields. This is estimated to add about $1.5 billion annually to our total oil income.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. The country's oil production has almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day since U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal and reimposed unilateral oil embargoes on Iran 3 years ago. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels a day, down from 2.5 million. Zangane says Iran plans to increase its oil production by more than twofold next year, to 4.5 million barrels per day.
Due to the sanctions, the share of oil exports in our annual budget has slashed by 14%, but the restrictions have pushed us to discover new domestic capacities to keep the oil industry afloat. All of these contracts have been signed with Iranian contractors. Furthermore, over 70% of the needed equipment are manufactured indigenously. We are not going to relinquish our domestic capacities in the oil industry, even if the sanctions are lifted.
Last year, oil exports accounted for 35% of Iran's budget. Along with the U.S. sanctions, the coronavirus pandemic has also squeezed Iran's oil revenues by cutting global demand.
While Iran is poised to make a strong comeback to the oil market, officials say crude revenues will cover only 25% of the country's next year budget, despite a projected rise in exports. This is Tehran is making a strategic shift to non-oil revenues to shield the economy from the ups and downs of its petroleum sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Leaders of Russia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan set for talks in the Russian capital Moscow to discuss the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh. The negotiations lasted about 4 hours, during which Russian President Vladimir Putin called for resolving issues connected with the peacekeeping operation, as well as clarification of demarcation lines, humanitarian problems, and protection of cultural heritage sites.
Today, we can note with satisfaction that trilateral agreements are applied in practice. We believe that it creates necessary conditions for a full-fledged settlement of the old conflict on the just basis in the interests of both Azeri and Armenian nations.
Putin thanked Aliyev and Pashinyan for the fact that they positively perceived the active mediation actions of Russia aimed at stopping the bloodshed and stabilizing the situation. After 6 weeks of deadly fighting in and around Karabakh in September, Yerevan and Baku eventually agreed on November 9th to end hostilities under a Moscow broker deal that secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan in Karabakh and seven surrounding districts. The situation seems calm, with the exchange of prisoners and bodies of the dead carried out smoothly.
I believe that the key to success is to put an end to the presence of non-regional players such as France and the U.S. Experience shows that integration of regional players lead to great achievements. As we saw in the case of Syria, regional conflicts are resolved only when regional players sit for talks.
Following the trilateral talks in the Kremlin, the parties signed a joint statement on the development of Nagorno-Karabakh. To this end, it was decided that a plan be presented in the near future by the deputy prime ministers of Russia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia.
2 months have passed since the ceasefire was signed. Our presence here shows that we are determined to fulfill the commitments made in September and November.
Unfortunately, today we couldn't resolve the issue of war prisoners. This is the most sensitive and painful issue. We agree to continue our cooperation in this area. We believe that the 8th paragraph of our joint statement has not yet been fully implemented. I hope we could make a concrete decision as soon as possible.
As part of the ceasefire, nearly 2,000 Russian peacekeepers have stationed along the Lachin Corridor in Azerbaijan, a 60 kilometers long route that links Khankendi to Armenia.
According to the Russian Ministry of Defense, by January 10th, over 48,000 refugees from Armenia returned to the region. The Russian department conducts round-the-clock monitoring of the situation and the ceasefire in the region. In addition, deepening work continues. Марина Картунова, Москва.
In less than 2 weeks, Democrat Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. But unlike the country's much-touted slogan of peaceful transition of power, nothing within the country seems peaceful. The capital, Washington, D.C., saw unprecedented fatal riots on the Capitol building. It all began after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump attacked Congress during its meeting to certify Biden's win in the November election. Officials have blamed Trump for inciting the violence as he kept refusing for months to concede defeat. They say U.S. democracy is in danger. President Trump now faces threats of impeachment just days before his tenure comes to an end. House Democrats have already drafted articles of impeachment against Trump over the Wednesday insurrection. The draft was prepared after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Trump to resign immediately. She also urged the invocation of the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment calls for the removal of a president who is unable to discharge his official duties. Trump has been shunned by many members of his own Republican Party as well. President-elect Biden has also called him one of the most incompetent presidents in U.S. history. Outside the country, world leaders, including Washington's allies, have criticized Trump supporters' attack on Capitol Hill.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters incited by the current president and other politicians. Violence has no place in our societies, and extremists will not succeed in overruling the will of the people.
Britain has reacted too.
President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
France criticized the Capitol riot, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel blamed Trump for sharing the blame. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro called the violence a reflection of what Washington has been using to do with other countries.
What we see that Donald Trump did, without a doubt, is what they're used to doing with the countries of the world. These same poor rural whites are the ones one sees dressed up as Superman, invading Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Panama, and Grenada.
The U.S. has always regarded itself as the bastion of democracy in the world. Now, the recent chaotic scenes are seen as undeniable proof of the fragility of democracy there, while they also mark an extraordinary moment in the American history.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-Ali al-Azim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. We were discussing some of the main features of the community of Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, and I talked last night about truthfulness, and I believe that this is a very important quality of a mu'min and also a Muslim community. Inshallah, I hope by the discussion that we have tonight, it will become crystal clear that truthfulness is very fundamental. It's not like some, for example, other qualities that are necessary, but even without them, you can still say, I am a mu'min, but not a good mu'min. No, without truthfulness, it's very difficult to be counted as a mu'min. Now, I want to start a Quranic discussion here about haq, and inshallah I mentioned some of the major points. It's such a broad concept and such a far-reaching concept in the Quran. Everything starts and